friend, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-author, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. Happy Friday. How are you?
I am super fantastic. Happy Friday right back at you. Looks like we've made our way through another week, and we've got a fun show lined up for tonight as well.
Absolutely. I'm going to start off with axolotls, right? We take pride in the fact that we can pronounce the word.
Well, you do. I always get it wrong. So, yeah, you take pride. But I'm always like, how do you say this thing? What I take pride in is the fact that this is not our first axolotl story. This is an update, okay? Because we were
talking about this creature last week.
Yeah, that's right. We were, and we got additional information. They're so interesting. We've got additional information. Just to put this in context, on Monday we talked a little bit about space and how Glenn Reynolds says, "Hey, people should be more aware of the fact that things are great, and we've got a golden age happening in space." And we took on that idea and we expounded on it. We said, "Not only are things great, this is the best time ever to be alive, as evidenced by the fact that we seem to be curing cancer and curing aging and doing all kinds of wonderful things, that there is real progress being made in taking on some of the biggest challenges that humans face." And we framed it as this wager about when would you rather be alive, and basically we'd rather be alive now or later, right, given the choice.
Yeah. In order to get Phil to go back in time, I had to offer him you're Neil Armstrong on the way to the moon. That's pretty much.
Yeah, you had me at Buzz Aldrin, but then I realized no, I was going to hold out for Neil. I had to be Neil Armstrong.
Yeah, that's right.
Otherwise, I wasn't going to take it. And now tonight we got a few more. We got just a few more things that kind of help back that up. Back up. This is more of a. Didn't I say recently that every show is pretty much us going, "See, we told you it was going to be like this," right? And I think that's what we're doing here tonight. Basically, this is, see, here's more proof that the world is really getting awesome. So the axolotl, what's the main distinguishing characteristic of this creature? It says here that it's a smiling animal, and it is an interesting-looking smiling animal. It looks like it stays a baby its whole life.
Yeah, the defining characteristic of most amphibians, or amphibians as a group, is that they start their lives as tadpole-type creatures in the water, and then they go on to land, at least for part of their life, as adults. But not this creature. It's like a tadpole its entire life.
It stays a tadpole, and apparently that keeps it well, just flush with the, what am I going to say, embryonic-type stem cells. It stays embryonic.
So it can regrow lots of different parts of its body completely. It's an amazing creature.
And that's really the distinguishing characteristic I was looking for. You know, you think about a salamander and its tail comes off and then it regrows a tail. And you hear about some creatures that it can lose a limb and it will regrow a limb. This thing regrows organs, okay? It doesn't scar. If you cut it, which is mean, don't do that, but it does not scar if you put a big gash in it. It all heals back. You take a limb off, it grows the whole limb back, bone, muscle, the whole thing. You damage its internal organs, it regrows those internal organs. It appears to have an almost unlimited regenerative capacity. That is the amazing thing about the axolotl. And its genome has just been sequenced. We talked about that a couple weeks ago and how that's really exciting, because potentially somewhere in that genome is the key to how you regenerate like this. And if you could do that.
Well, we got an update on this, right? So number one, if any of us are getting, have an ego problem because, the large size of our genomes, We need to
get over
yourself.
Yeah, get over
ourselves, because the axolotl has, it's like, how much bigger is it than the human genome? It's insane. It's like a 10
it's
times.
It's outrageous. They have 32 billion base pairs. Okay, so they're I don't know. It's like an order of magnitude bigger than ours. I mean, it's just huge. Compared to ours. That's mathematically what I just said is probably wrong, but it's a lot bigger, okay? And I'm not looking at the number right now. It's a lot bigger, so somebody's going to send me an email and tell me that I'm an idiot. But it's much, much bigger than the human genome. And apparently, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is there's just a lot of redundant information in there. But it could be that all that redundant information and the way it is sequenced might have something to do with their regenerative capability. And the other piece that we've learned is that we've now spotted what some of the regeneration genes are, okay? So two big things about the axolotl that have both occurred just since we did the initial axolotl story. One is, turns out this wasn't part of the story that we reported initially, and it's definitely worth talking about. They've got a huge genome, lots of information in there, and now it looks like we're pinpointing the pieces that seem to drive the regenerative capability. So if we're going to see any benefit for humans out of what we know about axolotls, that might come sooner rather than later, because we seem to be making some pretty significant progress with our understanding of these guys, don't we?
Absolutely. And I believe, Phil, that these guys are in danger, too. So it's an object lesson, and let's take care of our environment, right? We do not want to drive into extinction some animal that could tell us as much as the axolotl can. And as far as the world knows, the only axolotls left are those that are in labs. And so, great, take care of those little guys, and maybe one day we can get them back out in the environment again.
Yeah, here. I mean, we don't want to be driving animals to extinction anyway. But this is a shining reason on why it's a bad idea to let animals go extinct until we know nothing about. Here are these almost magical creatures that we could have driven extinct before we ever even began to understand how amazing they really are. And there's probably some other species out there that have a lot to teach us too. So yeah, let's go easy. Let's go easy on the environment. And it is kind of sad to think there's these amazing creatures, and the only ones that exist are in captivity, basically being experimented on, right? It's unfortunate.
It'd be nice if they could be reintroduced. I suspect, because of their water nature, that they might be susceptible to water pollution in their native Mexico. So, need to have some pristine water for them and back in their normal environment. Maybe that can be reintroduced. That would be great.
Let's bring back the axolotl. Absolutely. All right, so our next story, researchers create first stem cells using CRISPR genome activation. This is cool because it's an update on things, a couple of threads we've talked about in the past. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about CRISPR over the last few years, particularly the last couple of years, and particularly the last year, I guess, really, talking about interesting new therapies, exciting new therapies that are going to be the result of our ability to manipulate the genetic code. That's what CRISPR lets us do. Creating stem cells, well, that's been done in the lab for the last decade. I think actually they talk here about research that was done 12 years ago. And we talked about it. We talked about it in our blog, and we've talked about it since then on this podcast. Japanese scientist Shinya Yamanaka did an experiment in which he was able to take skin cells from the hand, I believe, and turn those back into pluripotent embryonic stem cells. It was first of its kind research back in the day, and it's been replicated numerous times since then. And this was done by, I believe, using proteins. He was introducing proteins into the cells, and it was a pretty complicated process of making it happen. And what we're seeing happen now is just an improved methodology for doing that. If you want to take skin cells and turn them into stem cells, it turns out CRISPR can make that happen just at the snap of a finger, right? It's a very straightforward process. And, of course, going back to the previous couple of stories about the axolotl, we know that stem cells are probably critical to that regenerative capability that those creatures have. The ability to produce new stem cells has got to have something to do with the ability to grow a new limb or to regrow an internal organ. And our ability to create those using CRISPR, I think, speaks very in a very positive way for all kinds of treatments for heart disease, for cancer, for just there's probably a lot of anti-aging applications for that as well.
Absolutely. Well, think of this, Phil. As we get older, we our pool of adult stem cells in our bodies diminishes over time. I mean, what if we could just replenish that, right? So that whenever we look and see, hey, this person has a low amount of adult stem cells, it's going to be a little difficult for their body to heal or get over illness or whatever. So let's, for when you do need it, let's replenish that pool a little bit, and your body will go to that pool when necessary. So that may turn out to be some sort of kind of almost a wellness here, that we're gonna take care of this problem before it is a problem.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that they use skin cells here, because I think one of the killer apps for stem cells is going to be cosmetics. You know, people use Botox to make their skin look younger, which is this crazy thing because you're actually killing part of your skin to do it, right? You're injecting this poison into your skin and killing the nerves or something to take the wrinkles out. Wouldn't another way to take the wrinkles out be to just put completely young skin in place? I mean, we're talking about how the axolotl doesn't scar. I think there must be some application down the road. Somebody's going to figure out a way to do this, to replace like older, tougher, wrinkly skin with just completely fresh, young skin, right? That's not blemished, that's not wrinkled. And that's going to be worth a lot. That would drive an awful lot of, research dollars.
I suspect our skin gets wrinkled and our hair gets white due to accumulation of mutations over time. If there's something that can be done so that we replenish the supply, basically, of young cells that your body can draw on, so yeah, the wrinkles are fading. Your hair is no longer white. That'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And before we leave this one, I just want to mention that the story, if you follow the link and read the story, it also mentions, in addition to CRISPR, a third way that they've come up with for generating stem cells. So I think, as important as stem cells are, not only for cosmetics and those kinds of treatments, but probably just for treating people who've been injured. You think about paralysis and some of those kinds of conditions. Obviously, treatments for burn victims and some of that kind of stuff. Stem cell therapies are going to be huge for so many different things that we're not even mentioning. And this goes back to what we were talking about on Monday's show and what we've touched on again here tonight, which is not just that progress is occurring, but that it's occurring in multiple dimensions all the time. There's several companies trying to launch rockets into space, right? There are several labs out there trying to address questions of how we treat aging and doing interesting experiments on mice. And now it turns out there's several different ways of taking mature cells and turning them into stem cells. The fact that all of these options exist, it kind of puts me in mind of the old analogy you used to make about Spock's chessboard.
Yes, and on Spock's chessboard. Okay, so I guess in order to explain that analogy, Phil, we got to explain the actual chessboard analogy, where things are happening exponentially from one space to the next on a normal chessboard, right?
Yeah, exactly. Chessboards are used as a good example of exponentials. If the old story is about the inventor of chess, who the emperor was going to reward him for his efforts, and he said, "Here, all I want is give me a grain of rice on the first square of the chessboard, then double it, make it two on the next square, make it four on the one after that, and just double until you've finished out the chessboard." And of course, because of exponential increase, they pretty quickly clear out the royal granaries, and there's no grain left in the kingdom, and they've only gotten about halfway through the board, right? So that's exponential. A chessboard is a symbol for things happening exponentially. But that wasn't good enough for Stephen Gordon, and he came up with another model.
I said, we got Spock's chessboard, because we're doing things, and it's not just one chessboard that we're seeing exponential development. We're seeing it
right.
A multiple
platform. And we should explain that, too. Okay, so on Star Trek,
the Vulcans played this 3D version of chess, right, where there were a three-leveled chessboard. So just for those who don't immediately know what we mean when we say Spock's chessboard, I guess.
Yes, I should say 3D chess is what we're talking about. So we got multiple platforms that we're seeing exponential development on. So it's, pretty exciting. And the redundancy is what makes it exciting. You know, let's say that we're wrong to be excited about 90% of the things we talk about, Phil, because you know none of it pan. And, you know, 90% of the stuff doesn't pan out. You know what? I'm still excited. 10% will. You know?
Absolutely.
And, so
the chances that any of the 10% will pan out, I think, are fantastic. It doesn't all have to pan out. And the thing is, if you've got three ways of generating stem cells, probably one of them will prove to be the most advantageous for most applications, and that it will become the standard. But the fact that there are multiple approaches just goes to show you that it's a solvable problem, and that at this point we're talking about how do we best do it rather than can we do it. And that's pretty amazing. That's a nice jump to have made. Okay, we're gonna get the geek out here in a moment, but I think we got one more story, and this is an interesting one. Google is using 46 billion data points to predict the medical outcomes of hospital patients. Now, this sounds like kind of a downer when you look at it, but basically, we're talking about some highly sophisticated statistical analysis of patient data, and they can tell just at the time you check in what's going to happen to you, which is kind of scary when you think about predictive analytics. Here you are, you're this age. You've had this happen to you, you got these symptoms. They know if you're going to die, basically. I mean, the model will tell if you're going to die. So that sounds very negative, and it sounds very scary. But there's a lot more, I think, to this than just that.
Think about it this way, Phil. It's a lot of times doctors do not know where to put their time, right?
Right, right.
You got some kid that's complaining of abdominal pain. Okay, but I got this other person that's actively bleeding over here. Well, it turns out the abdominal pain kid needed attention that minute because he has a ruptured appendix, right? And the analytics would have told him that's where he needed to be putting his attention, and you know, have the nurses put pressure on this one guy. I've got to deal with this kid right now because he's about to die. And maybe he wouldn't have not known that without this analytics. I see this as a completely not scary at all, but we want intelligence for the medical community. We want more analytics like this so that they can,
I think so
they
too,
can, spend their time where they need to.
In fact, when I read this, I thought, well, what this is the next iteration of triage. Triage is the idea of you're going to deal with the patients that the resources will allow you to deal with who need it the most first, right? It's a set of parameters developed in wartime where sometimes you can't help a guy at all on the battlefield, right? You just give him some morphine and it's too late. There's not much you can do for him. But others, it's like it's critical, but they can be saved, so you give them the attention first. And another group, they definitely need attention, but they can wait a while, right? So triage was always this idea of who do you treat when and what treatment do you apply. Well, machine learning, this kind of advanced predictive analytics can give you a whole new dimension on that. And I think what you said is exactly right. A lot of these outcomes where, because they present these symptoms, we know they're going to die. Is it because they're certain to die, or is it because being checked into the normal procedure guarantees that?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Could a quarter of them be saved?
The example I gave, then you save both of those patients, both the guy that's actively bleeding and the kid, because you go to the kid first and deal with that, and then you come back to the guy. Often, you just get on the phone and call in more doctors if you need to. You got to know that you've got the problem. And the more tools you have to help you understand what you're confronted with, the better, as far as I'm concerned. So,
and this
I've
is,
actually got a geek out that sort of speaks to that.
Okay, well, before we go there, I want to say one more thing about why I think this is important, and it's that we have those data points for people checking into a hospital, but ultimately we have a lot of data points about ourselves anyway, and we use that one crisis moment to say we know what the outcome is. We got this whole quantified self movement going on now, where people are tracking data about themselves and recognizing their outcomes. I think if you take that
checking into the hospital and back it up to earlier portions of our lives, you know, when we're not in crisis. If you had a model that showed, you know what, if you keep eating that breakfast every day, you've got a 30% chance of making it another year or whatever it would be, right? The statistics can show that people who engage in the behaviors you engage in, here's what happens, right? 90% of the time they're dead in 5 years or something like that. I think it can really make a difference in a lot of lifestyle choices and stuff like that.
It kind of guides you to some better choices, right? I mean, and
absolutely.
And sometimes, sometimes these things are obvious, you know. If you're smoking, you probably should stop that. that seems like a no-brainer, but you know, but there may be some things that we're not quite aware of that you know, we need to alter our diets just a little bit to, you know, to bring in different vitamins, you know, and nutrients and things like that. And maybe we don't know, and we can use a little guidance. So yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. I think the more data, the better, and the more accurate the predictive models, the better off we are. Even if they tell us some things we don't want to hear, that's okay, because the only way we can avoid the bad outcomes or mitigate them is to know they're coming and to have as good information on them as we can. But anyway, you were about to geek us out on this very subject. So
yeah, on this very thing. Do you remember the television show The Dead Zone, Bill?
Sure. Stephen King novel, and then a movie, and then a TV show. Yes.
That's right. The TV show, there was a particular episode, and I, when I saw this story and I was reminded of this episode, I went and looked it up. It's episode 9 of season 1, and it's called The Siege. And in this show, a guy that's kind of, you know, done wrong by the by a bank, right? He's, you know, being let go or whatever. He decides to take a bunch of people hostage, and so Johnny enters the bank. He's the main guy. He's the guy that can see what the future is, right? That's
right.
What his power is, you know. And throughout the entire show, when something is about to happen, he can see what the outcome of that is. And it's almost invariably negative. Oh crap! If we go down this road, the bad guy's going to be dead with about four other people. And he kept playing it, you know, and doing and avoiding those bad outcomes by trying something different from what was about to happen at the time he had his vision of the future.
Right.
So it's a little bit like that. It's the sort of the God's eye view of things that this analytics perhaps can give us. So we go, you know what? We won't go down that road. We can avoid the bad outcome because we know enough to know that if we continue in this direction, it's not going to be good. So
and especially when there are several potential bad outcomes, it just becomes all the more important that you keep navigating, right? That you have some means of measuring what that narrow, crooked path that actually gets you where you want to be might be. Because there, statistically, there is probably a best path. Actually, there has to be, right? There has to be one path that has better outcomes than any of the others, even if that one's not great. Right? So no matter what, you're better off. I mean, even in the show, not to spoil the end, but he was better off being able to see what was going to happen, because eventually, I bet, he finds a way out of it. Not to spoil a show I never saw, but you know, I just have this feeling. Call it
an episodic TV show, so I don't guess you're spoiling that. Wasn't an episode.
He was alive for episode 10. Exactly.
That's right.
All right. Well, while we're geeking out, let's carry on. I think we've got one major geek out story here that you shared, and this is on a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. We've talked a few times, I think, over the years about the Voynich manuscript, and there have been quote-unquote solutions to it offered here and there. Mysterious manuscript from no one's quite sure when. The existing piece of it is about, I think, 300 years old. It's written in the script. It's hard to decipher. It's got strange pictures all through it. It's colorful. It's beautiful. Interesting-looking thing, but it seems to make absolutely no sense whatsoever and has driven
it's
people
a huge, heavy thing. It's 240 pages. Still existing. There's some pages that are missing. I can see that. But there's 240 pages in this thing, and it's all on leather, right? It's on tanned leather pages. And so you can imagine how big of a and heavy of a book we're talking about.
Right. And theories of its origins are everything from, well, it's just a hoax, to, no, it's deliberate gibberish because somebody back in the day wanted to own a book, and you could do that back then. You could just have a scribe write a bunch of gibberish, and at least they'd have a book there in their library, so it would look nice. To my personal pet theory, which is that it's an artifact from a parallel universe, right, where that language does make sense, and those pictures look like something that that correspond to the natural world in that world. To lots of other theories, I mean, there have been no limit to the theories, but it's been declared at times completely unsolvable. And now this story is saying not so fast, right?
Not so fast. I mean, it was unsolvable to the World War II code breakers. They tried it as sort of a puzzle to work on while they were trying to break the codes of the Nazis. And they were never able to solve it. And like you say, Phil, over the last 10 years or so, there's been some advances. And so, but they still didn't have, anything really of substantial. So what they did was they put AI to work on this thing. And the first thing they put the AI to work on was, what language is this in?
Right.
And they went into it with the assumption that it was probably a form of Arabic, and they were wrong. It turns out it was Hebrew, and to a high degree of probability, it turned out to be Hebrew. And so they go, okay, that's helpful to know what language this is an encoding of. And then they put the AI again to work. To determine what sort of cipher they were dealing with. And they thought that there was previous researchers who thought that it might be an alphagram. In other words, that's when you take the letters in every single word and put those letters in alphabetical order. And since this was a Gizmodo article, the author, Cory Doctorow, by the way, said, Gizmodo would be spelled DGIMOOZ in that cipher because it's an alphabetical order that way.
Right, right.
And so they armed with that knowledge, they went back to it, and they began to see some real progress. And they got something that was beginning to make sense. And then they lastly used Google Translate to put those words in the proper order for English, because Hebrew has, they put their words in different orders to make a sentence. So that final polish from Google Translate helped a lot. And it still is an odd way to open up the book. The first sentence of this book apparently is, "She made recommendations to the priest, the man of the house, and me and the people." So,
At any rate, it would be the weirdest thing of all is if that's literally what it says, okay, and it turns out it is just this heavily encoded Hebrew gibberish, right? It still doesn't mean anything, right? Even when you
in the last couple of years, it's basically been determined, or at least most of the experts in this document have decided that it's like a women's health manual. Everything they knew about how to take care of a woman's body. Well, I suspect some doctor, way back in the early Middle Ages, this respected but elderly midwife, and he wants to get all of her information before she dies, and so he starts off the book. It's just for his own benefit, so he doesn't care how it's written. And he's first sentence says, "Well, she made these recommendations to the priest, the man of the house, and me, and everybody else." And so here we go. And he knew who she was.
You made sense of the first line.
Yeah, he knew who she was. She was this great midwife, right? And so maybe it was something like that. And so at any rate, it's odd, but you know what? We weren't expecting anything that was normal. We should have expected odd, right?
No, we're expecting odd. Well, I'll need to see more of the text and see if you can make sense of more of the text, because I was reading complete gibberish there. But there, you turned that into a coherent sentence and even put it in context. So it's interesting to think, if that's what it is, why would you go to all the trouble to so deeply encode such a banal text, right?
Keeping in mind, this was back in the days when, if you wanted to learn something, you'd go apprentice for somebody, right?
Right.
And a language
was
hidden. You know, if you wanted to be a mason and lay bricks, there was you go apprentice with them, and they try to hide their techniques for making arches and things like that, right? So that they would be special in that. You know, I think you're dealing with a doctor here who wanted to be the world's best and didn't want to share this information with anybody else.
So he encoded it so that he would have it and no one else could get it. Not a very likable person, this guy behind the Voynich manuscript, if that's the story. But anyway, it's the closest we've gotten to an actual explanation. So we'll have to stay tuned as they keep reading it and see if that explanation actually does pan out.
Yep.
Fun stuff. All right. Well, Stephen, it's been a great week. Have enjoyed talking with you. We've covered an awful lot of ground. And I'll tell you what, let's come back and do it again next week. We've got three brand new shows to do then. It's been great having you all with us, and we look forward to being with you all again. And until next time,
live to see it.